Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Thursday, September 4th, 2003. Today's session is entitled James and Works. James, chapters 1, verse 1 through 25, chapter 2, verse 14 through chapter 3, verse 18, chapter 5, verse 7 through 20. Session 4 of Paul and James, Being Both Just and Free. It's a Bible study with Michael Wyatt. Let's listen in.
Michael Wyatt, you're from D.C., and what we're doing is looking at the letter of Paul to the Galatians and the letter of James, trying to bring these two people into the conversation that they seem to have had such a hard time having in real life. So. Once again, is there anything left over from yesterday? We looked at sort of Paul's theological portion of the letter to Galatians, and do you have anything from yesterday that you want to bring up, or another comment you want to make, or something? I guess since most of you are Lutherans, Paul is not the issue, it's James that we need to talk about. What we're doing today, and I've, as you have seen, cut James up into rather odd bits, in part it's just the nature of the letter. Like I said before, it's a letter that tends to read very much like a collection of James's favorite sayings, and so doesn't read with a great deal of consistency. But what I wanted to do was, on our second session, make very clear James's trajectory out of Hebrew prophecy with his strong emphasis on social justice. He really positions himself very clearly in line with folks like Amos and Hosea, denouncing the rich and their oppression of the poor. So it was very important for us to see him keeping that voice of Hebrew social justice alive. Today, we're looking at the portions of the letter that lean in two other directions. One is James keeping alive the sayer of Proverbs, the elder, the one who has folk wisdom, who sort of gathers the community and says, well, you know, this is how we really ought to be together. It's going to be a more conciliatory voice. And in fact, you might even wonder if this is the same guy speaking that was speaking on Tuesday, because there's such a strong contrast between the James, the portions of James we're going to read today, and the ones that you remember from Tuesday, where he was so uncompromising in his denunciation. The other thing that we're doing today is looking at the section in James where all the evidence is he wants to take on what he understands to be certainly the abuse of Paul's insistence that you cannot be justified by the works of the law. And James wants to do a counter move to that. So I wanted you to hear very clearly in session 3 how Paul argues this in Galatians. And we spent time yesterday sort of showing what Paul preached, or at least my impression. I realize it was a very personal, very eccentric reading of Paul, perhaps. But certainly my impression of how Paul preached and what Paul's message was, why it became obvious to him that the law was something that you would not want to return to. You were beyond the law. And then how that, of course, might have been heard by those who were not present when Paul was actually preaching and guiding the congregations would have created some of the misunderstandings that James is now trying to counter. I said in my write-up that James is very concerned that we not be couch potatoes spiritually, that we not sort of assume that since I've got enough faith, I've done my bit, you know, God and I are good to go, so I can just sit down at this point. And for James, that's absolutely abhorrent, not only because of his strong social justice sense, but also because that just, to him, does not compute. That makes no sense. So we're going to be looking at the portions of the letter also today where James is sort of shadow boxing with Paul, or at least with the abuse of Paul's teaching. We'll start then with the very opening of the letter, which is James, if you will, as sage, James as elder, James as the one who is counseling patience and endurance. This is a very, again, feels like a kind of wandering portion of the letter. James seems to touch on a variety of different themes here, but one of the thing that traces through, if at least as I read it, is that there are different kinds of endurance that are being called on. It might be wise for us just to go ahead and read out loud all of chapter 1 so that we sort of get that in the air and can then begin to do some discussion of it. Why don't I go ahead and do this rather than ask somebody else to read so much? He says, "My brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it nothing but joy, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its full effect, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you is lacking in wisdom, ask God, who gives to all generously and ungrudgingly, and it will be given to you. But ask in faith, never doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For the doubter, being double-minded and unstable in every way, must not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Let the believer who is lowly boast in being raised up, and the rich in being brought low, because the rich will disappear like a flower in the field. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the field, its flower falls, its beauty perishes. It's the same way with the rich. In the midst of a busy life, they will wither away. Blessed is anyone who endures temptation. Such a one has stood the test and will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. No one, when tempted, should say, 'I am being tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, and himself tempts no one. But one is tempted by one's own desire, being lured and enticed by it. And then, when that desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and that sin, when it is fully grown, gives birth to death. Do not be deceived, my beloved. Every generous act of giving with every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. In fulfillment of his own purpose, he gave us birth by the word of truth, so that we would become a kind of first fruits of his creatures. You must understand this, my beloved. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger, for your anger does not produce God's righteousness. Therefore, rid yourselves of all sordidness and rank growth of wickedness, and welcome with meekness the implanted word that has the power to save your souls. But be doers of the word, and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, they are like those who look at themselves in a mirror. For they look at themselves and on going away immediately forget what they were like. But those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they will be blessed in their doing. If any think they are religious and do not bridle their tongues, but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained from the world." Excuse me. So, what do you make of this? Like I say, it seems like it's kind of meandering, but do you find any threads that seem to connect? How would you hear this discourse? Yes, ma'am.
One way to hear it is that specific problems are being addressed.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to name some that you see there?
Being tempted by bad things. Speaking without thought and concern. The rich versus those who are not rich.
Again, that's going to get introduced early.
Wisdom. What wisdom is, what faith is.
And it seems to me that in all of this, James is describing a person who is... how do I say this? It's a word that for us is not a popular word, but in the time in which James was writing was a very important word, which is in Greek. Apathetic. Pathos has been removed from this person. Passion has been removed from this person. This is the person who is able to endure at the beginning. Notice he's talking about under trials, probably the persecutions. Paul himself may have been part of this at one point, but certainly the persecution was picked up under other circumstances, is able to not give vent to their emotions by speaking harshly, is able to remain unmoved in the face of temptation. In other words, the person who is not driven by their pathos, driven by their passions. Like I say, we in our own day, perhaps having had too much of this teaching from the church, are looking for, once again, the fires to be kindled a bit. But in the more passionate first century of Christianity, this was a considerable virtue. This ability to be able to step back and be unmoved, not in the sense that you were indifferent to what was around you, but that you weren't whipped back and forth by your emotional reactions to things. So in the very first verses, there's endurance during trials, during persecution. There's the business about how to approach the rich and the poor. You simply do this very sort of long-term view. They're rich for now. Riches come and go. Riches fade. It'll fade like a flower in the field. It'll wither away. In your own temptations, you don't give in. When you want to retort to someone, when you want to strike out verbally, you don't let your tongue do that. You bridle your tongue. In all of this, the person is, in fact, being, as we would say, serene, unmoved, under control. That, to me, seems the thread that goes through this first chapter. And very much, like I say, it's the sage, the elder, who is telling you, you know, you want to make it to old life. You want to arrive at a serene old age. This is how you do it. By not getting caught up, by not getting moved, by not getting thrown off balance.
This is, as you say, this is a very controlled voice. And a very conciliatory voice, but I can't help but wonder whether or not that reference to the unbridled tongue is a direct reference to Paul.
Well, we don't know that necessarily, but there will be other references, sharper later on, about the destructiveness of the tongue. And let's just bracket that comment and look more closely at what might be going on with the unbridled tongue when we get to those passages. Right now, it's almost like he's introducing a theme. And in chapter 3, he spends nearly the entire chapter talking about the problems of an unbridled tongue. So we'll get to that. What do you make now of the very interesting statement about if you lack wisdom, which again, for the mind of antiquity, would be this sort of apathetic stance, this sort of judicious stance. Ask God, who gives to everyone. But he says, ask in faith, never doubting, for one who doubts is like a wave in the sea. The doubter is double-minded, unstable in every way, and must not expect to receive anything from the Lord. How do you interpret that? What do you make of that?
Well, it's hard to hear, because if you have any doubts, it doesn't sound like that's a very good position to be in.
It almost sounds like you have to have wisdom before you can pray for wisdom. You have to be stable before you can pray for stability. Mm-hmm. You have to have faith before you can pray for faith. Mm-hmm. What else might we say about this? I mean, it is disturbing. So in what sense might he be meaning doubts here?
Well, maybe, you know, we talk about a church belief having certain beliefs or certain creeds, and he's part of that. Mm-hmm. So he's talking about those particular things, maybe, and as long as we can, as a church, hold together with those, we're going to be more stable, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, the fleeting doubts that people would have. You know, the more contentious, bigger issues than just small doubts that come and go.
Right.
Maybe that's what I perceive of it. I'm not sure.
And that sort of makes sense to me, a kind of radical agnosticism or radical skepticism. Mm-hmm. If you're approaching God with this, I'm, you know, really not sure about any of this.
Yeah.
then it is harder for you to perceive that there's any answer at all. Was your hand up in the back?
Well, I just read a thing this morning, I can't remember who wrote it, about praying with confidence that your prayer is going to be heard. So this could also be a reference, perhaps, to a problem that we all still have today, which is my prayers are unworthy, or I am not worthy. So I pray with doubt, not so much about God's ability, but doubt in whether or not my prayers are appropriate or acceptable or worthy. And I don't know, but because I'm lacking in wisdom, because I doubt, because I don't, it sort of compounds itself into this. And so perhaps it's encouraging confidence in one's own prayers.
Yeah, and I think that makes good sense to me, certainly. What else will you want to say about this?
Well, he's obviously pushing very hard for people not to just be faithful, but to also express their faith, do good works, get out and show their faith.
And this is an interesting dimension of this. One would wonder if the doubting, if the double-mindedness is not an indirect way of moving into this. You know, you can't believe one thing and not act on it. You know, you can't ask for things, in other words, be a Christian recipient, but not a Christian agent, if you will. So there's that kind of edge of double-mindedness perhaps here as well, in addition to the sort of theological doubts and the personal worthiness doubts that we've already talked about. Lila, your hand is up.
Well, does James, is this an indirect reference? I mean, would he see Paul as pretty double-minded? And we talked about, you know, Paul as, you know, his conversion experience was radical. I mean, it was, you know, in this thing of, you know, if you've been a Jew and you've been in the church and you've obeyed the law and you've been steadfast, you've been really steadfast. And I just wondered if he's talking to the people about, you know, if someone comes in and they've led one life and now they lead another life and they question things and they wonder about things. I just wondered if he was thinking about Paul at all.
Well, and even if it's not Paul specifically, what I like about your comment is that if there's a person who has one foot in the church and one foot out, who is sort of always maneuvering to find, you know, which is the most advantageous position for me to be in at this moment, I think that would certainly classify for James as a double-minded person, you know, and one that he will say is deceiving himself or herself later on. There is, of course, also the sense in which, given where this is placed in the chapter, the double-mindedness, this is just one other comment to make, not because all of these are worthy interpretations of this, but another way also to think about it is, given the context of the chapter in which he's talking about persecution, in which he's talking about temptation, in which he's talking about the instabilities and uncertainties of the congregation, that these things also would create states of double-mindedness. You know, once persecution has closed in on you, you do begin to wonder, am I really in the right place? You know, all I have to do is say, Jesus, I don't have an idea. Who is that man? Never heard about him. You know, do the Peter maneuver. And you can, in fact, avoid persecution. But, of course, that also would be double-minded. In temptation, the same thing. The more you entertain the temptation and keep wondering, well, should I, shouldn't I, shouldn't I, shouldn't I, should I, shouldn't I, really? Of course, that's also, this playing with the temptation is also being double-minded. Also, as he says, interestingly enough, trying to blame the temptation on something other than yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, the devil is making you do this. Which is, of course, another kind of double-minded function. You sort of project out. So I think in the context of this first chapter, those are also some clues about what this double-mindedness might be. Vacillation under temptation, vacillation under persecution, vacillation also when we want to lash out at someone, when we don't want to bridle our tongue. Yes?
Well, I don't know quite how it goes, but I heard a talk one time, you talked about doubts are the catalyst that leads to faith.
No question.
I mean, doubts are good.
Yes.
Because they bring you closer.
Yeah. And I think we want to be careful to discriminate here between the honest questioning, where we're not sure about something, we want to continue to deepen in faith and to explore it more further. And that kind of honest doubt is not what James is talking about here. That's not the double-mindedness where you are, in a sense, trying to play two sides of one issue. You know, trying to be safe from persecution and yet a faithful Christian on Sunday morning. You know, and that's a very different thing from being uncertain about some dogmatic tenet or some teaching. One of the things we want to look at very carefully, because James is going to be setting up now the groundwork for his diatribe against Paul's teaching, are verses 22 through 25. Be doers of the word, and you were talking about these verses exactly. Be doers of the word and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. Here's again that sort of hint about what it means to be double-minded. You know, you hear but you don't act. You're a good passive, receptive Christian. You're never an active Christian. Certainly a double-minded situation. And as far as James is concerned, a self-deceiving situation. For if any are hearers of the word and not doers, they are like those who look at themselves in a mirror. They look, they forget themselves, and they go away. But if you look into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they will be blessed in their doing. What do you want to say about this? Because like I say, this is an important set of verses. This is James laying the groundwork for his position against Paul, or against the abuse of Paul. Yes,
now they're talking. James is talking about the Mosaic law.
I don't think here in the not in the perfect law, the law of liberty.
Okay.
I think he also, and that's a very shrewd comment, because he also has enlarged the category of law. We're under some other law at this point, and for him, it's this perfect law, the law of liberty. Remember in. What we saw on Tuesday, verse 8 of chapter 2, you do well if you really fulfill the royal law. And then he'll come back later on to the law of liberty at another point in this letter. So he's, in an interesting way, enlarging the law as it's been received in the Torah. This is not to contradict the Torah. He is very much in line with the things John was talking about yesterday in his session. You know, you've heard it said in the past, don't commit adultery. But I say, you know, don't even look with lust. I mean, Jesus is enlarging of the graphic law, the factual law, the sort of more flat-footed law. And I really think that's what James is doing here in this sort of law of liberty. It's going to be a larger way to live. Yes, ma'am?
At the same time, isn't he also shrinking it? Because the references he makes are really pretty strictly to kind of the Decalogue and not the greater Torah law, but the Ten Commandments, and
mm-hmm.
with the
ones
of
he
you shall love your neighbor as your, I mean, that's really what he references
mm-hmm.
throughout.
Mm-hmm.
So while he's expanding it, he's also not diminishing, but
mm-hmm.
restricting his understanding of the core of the law, maybe?
Well, he's certainly bringing it into focus in a certain way, and Paul will do, as we will see, exactly the same thing, that there is a way in which we want to focus our understanding of the law rather than get caught up in the minutiae of it. It's hard for me to know if James is in any sense dismissing all the other precepts of the Torah. The fact that he doesn't mention them, you know, sort of how do you argue from absence? I mean, it's a tricky argument. But you're absolutely right that the ones that he chooses to pull out are either from the Decalogue or the sort of overarching commandment of loving your neighbor as yourself, which he calls the royal law. So it's his version, if you will, of the golden rule. This is the royal law, if you just love your neighbor as yourself. Yes, sir?
Isn't he talking about regular self-reflection in this, when looking at the mirror, to look, and I guess you could take that either two ways, you know, the reflection of knowing that you're created for good works,
mm-hmm.
or you could, you know, also reflect on, you know, you're falling short. You know,
mm-hmm.
I haven't quite measured up. So it could go two ways, but I think I was talking about a person maybe that looks at themselves in the mirror once a year, once a month, and for, you know, is grabbed by the desires that you know, forgetting about God,
mm-hmm.
kind of just get caught up in the busyness of the world. that she talks about too.
I would put this actually next to our experience of Sunday morning and listening to scripture read and listening to the sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not we listen with the sense of what am I to absorb, what am I to take in, what am I to consider as a practice for this week,
mm-hmm.
or whether we're thinking, did I turn the oven on? At which point, you know, in fact, we are. It's exactly the situation of looking in the mirror and going away and forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the issue. It's whether or not you put yourself in an entirely passive and receptive mode.
Mm-hmm.
And to preach the wonderful sermon, you know, best sermon that preacher's ever preached. You get home and someone asks you, well, what was it about? Well, you know, it was fabulous, but... And the thing that makes a difference there is if you're actually listening for what must I do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what am I being told to do? And then lifting out of that, what are my actions for the coming week? Some people do work with sermons that way. I think some preachers intend for their sermons to be worked with that way. But that shifts it entirely from simply being sort of in the wash of the words to actually picking things that you're going to work with. You had your hand up, I think.
I have a feeling here that James is on a totally different planet from Paul. He's talking about listening,
mm-hmm.
while Paul is talking about
a revelation,
which internalizes this and changes our lives completely.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather like the impression that some of us who have grown up in the church and have always felt that we were a part of Christianity have when we are almost assaulted by someone who has just had a conversion,
mm-hmm.
and is sure that all the rest of us should do the same.
Absolutely, yeah. Even though, let me just push back and contradict, and it's interesting, there might be some hints of the Pauline experience, because you remember in Paul's first line of argument with the folks from Galatia, he said, did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law or by believing what you heard? So it's very clear for Paul that there is a sense that hearing is crucial to how, in fact, you receive this experience. So it may be that James is beginning to think, huh, you know, hearing is not quite enough. And again, having a kind of debased understanding of what Paul is actually teaching and doing, in which he would say, well, gosh, if all they do is listen to Paul preach, that's not going to help them very much. You know, it's got to be more than just listening to someone preach. You know what I'm saying? So there's a kind of reduction of even what Paul was doing into a sort of paper tiger that James can then say, no, not this. So I wonder sometimes how much James actually knew of what the Pauline gospel was. The other thing that I want to underscore here, because it's going to be helpful for us as we move through these texts and then tomorrow try to do some comparison between Paul and James. In Paul's writings, he talks a lot about the works of the law and uses a word, ergo, works. Now, you know this word, energy is related to this. The erg, in ergi, energy is works. Energy is what enables works to happen. Okay, but what's very fascinating about this is that the erga tend to be slightly impersonal. The works are done. You know, there's a kind of generic feel to this particular word. What James asks people, I want to make sure I spell this right, to be involved in he wants them to be, if you look at verse 25, doers of work. He wants them to be poietes, ergo. That's the dative sense of this, possessive sense of this. In other words, it's not so much that the works are starting to be done, but James says he wants you to actually be the doers of whatever these works are. This word's a very interesting word. What does that word look like to you?
Piety.
Well, actually, we have it.
Right.
Poetry. I mean, this is the most direct connection for us in English of what this word is. And it means, actually, making. For in this case, not a making, but a poietis is a maker. Interestingly enough, to me, there is a way in which James is talking not about relying on works that sort of happen, but about beginning to think of yourself as a craftsman, as a technician of righteousness, as a maker of righteousness. And if you want to get this cut to the chase and pick up this one English derivative of it, as a kind of creator of a poem of righteousness, you know, that you want to be the one that builds righteousness. The term poietes is any kind of maker, was often used of, say, a potter or a weaver or a carpenter, someone that has a skill, that has a technique, and who can do something excellently, who can make something excellently. This is very different from this sort of vague generic works, because, let me shut up and say, what does that evoke for you to be a poet or a maker of works rather than simply a doer?
Something creative.
Absolutely. The perfect law, the law of liberty. Something creative. What?
Experimental. I mean, you keep doing it, you look back and you're able to look and say, well, maybe if I try a little tweak over here, you know, and something that you do a lot and you love doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if it's our English translation of James or not, but in that sense, I get the sense that I am able to use the gifts that I have been given to live out this law of liberty so that there, my parameters will not necessarily be the same as someone, as my neighbor's parameters, because mm-hmm. my abilities are different than my neighbor's,
mm-hmm.
And given to me by God, mm-hmm. so that it's not wrong that mine are different from my neighbor's, and it's mm-hmm. not wrong for my neighbor's to be different from mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get that sense from what Paul says, because he seems to, and maybe it's, again, the English translation, but he seems to have very clear parameters of what that should look like.
Are you saying, you said Paul, do you mean Paul?
Sorry, James.
Okay, yeah.
James seems to have very clear parameters of what the law of liberty should look like, and maybe that's where I kind of rub up against it, because with this understanding, I can appreciate that. Mm-hmm. To my ability, I live out this law of liberty, and to mm-hmm. your ability, you live out that law of liberty, mm-hmm. but I can't tell you how to do that, because mm-hmm. I don't know what God has given you to
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm. And very much, I mean, what you're saying, which is makes perfect sense to me, and, except that I'm not sure that James is quite as restrictive, but we can continue to read the book and see. But absolutely, there's a sense in which my sense of agency, and therefore what gifts I've been given, mm-hmm. matter a great deal in how I make whatever the righteousness is that is called for in a particular situation. I think for me, the striking difference also between this has a very strong sense of agency. This really does call out the person who must do these things. There must be an agent. There must be an actor. Whereas when you talk about the works of the law, like I said, this is very impersonal. And it begins to feel almost like there's a kind of transaction in Paul's language. You know, somehow the works of the law, whatever those are, they accumulate. We put our trust in them. There's hardly ever any sense of agency. There's a sense simply of a kind of transaction that we want to trust. This is true to the Greek. The energetic working is in Greek usage a kind of impersonal energetic working. The works of the law are impersonal. You cannot do poiesis impersonally. Poiesis has to have an agent. So in an interesting way, you would expect this from Paul, but in an interesting way, James is the one who says, you have to be the one who in fact has to act. You have to do this. You have to make the righteousness of God. Remember this interesting verse, your anger does not produce God's righteousness. Very curious. Paul would say God's righteousness doesn't need to be produced. God's righteousness is, and God's righteousness has been bestowed on us. We have been reckoned righteous because God has bestowed that on us. James starts us at another place. We must produce God's righteousness. So there's again this vision, if you will, of a world that can be just, where there can be a more equitable economic balance and things, and all of that is for us to become poietes ergo, to be the makers of. Anything else before we move on? Yes, sir.
I had two things that came to mind. Number one is that beginning it says it's for the 12 tribes in dispersion in the diaspora, and then it ends up with treating the orphan and the widow. And because I love Matthew, I immediately thought of Matthew written for Christian Jews, and I thought of the Last Judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever you do to the least, you do unto me. The second thing, what you just were talking about in James, reminded me of the hymn that Lila led last night.
Yes, yes.
Christ has no body, nothing but yours.
Right, right. And if we don't make, you know, if we don't become the technicians of this just world, it doesn't happen. And I think the question is not that we're doing it over against God, but it's exactly the issue in Lila's hymn. What other hands does God have but ours? And so we want our hands to be the skilled hands of a craftsman in economic justice, as far as James is concerned. Yes?
Just out of curiosity, to be the devil's advocate, is God powerless then without us?
Oh, no, I don't think he would say that. I don't think James would say that.
Okay.
But I think that in... Let's look at his polemic against Paul, because I think there's some interesting insights into that in those passages that are about to come up. So we're going to skip on, unless there's anything else about this sort of law of liberty, this perfect law.
James makes Paul sound like a Nike commercial. Just do it. Mm-hmm. Whether you have the gift for it or not.
It's true. It's true. And I think it's... I think in some ways, James is the more careful administrator. I mean, Carol was making this point, and Paul more the charismatic leader, you know, who has this one vision that's held out to sort of galvanize and encourage people. And then James is the one who says, great, fabulous, now how do we put that together? You know. If we skip now to verse 14 of chapter 2, this is where James is going to be attacking the understanding that he has of the Pauline message. It's very interesting to me that after these verses that we just saw in chapter 1, 22 through 25, where he talks about being doers, you know, what we want to do is be the poets, the craftsmen of righteousness. Here he shifts to Paul's language. He no longer talks about our being doers. It's very clear for him, at least, that the tension is not between are you going to be a Pauline Christian or are you going to be a doer of righteousness, a doer of the act. He goes right over to Paul's language and says the question is works. So again, he uses this word that I've erased, erga, instead of his word, all the cognates of poiesis, of making. He does, and this is wonderful. I said in my little blurb about this that James indulges in sarcasm. He certainly does in this section. It has some of the funniest, one of the funniest verses to me in the entire Bible. And what is going on here is James's reductio ad absurdum. He's reducing to absurdity the extreme positions of the Pauline gospel. Okay, if you want to become a spiritual couch potato, three ways he's going to show how absurd that is. The first is in verse 15 and 16. What do you make of those two verses? Somebody read them out loud just so we hear them.
It
If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and eat your fill, and that you do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead.
And at this point, interesting enough, he calls faith dead. Very curious. So what do you make of this?
Well, I would call it a head-on confrontation with Paul.
No question. Do you think James's argument is valid?
Yes.
So James wins. And I don't want us to put him up in a boxing match either, because I think that that is a misunderstanding on both sides, which we'll want to talk about tomorrow. But clearly, in this particular point, James wins this round. You know, it does no good if you go to someone and say, you know, I want you to be warm and well fed, then you put on your coat and go home to supper. That, as far as James is concerned, is dead faith. And it's the first, again, he's not saying anybody does this. He's saying, again, this is the reductio ad absurdum. This is how you turn this absurd. If you just go that all you need is faith and you don't need works, this line of argument ought to make sense. But we see that it's absurd. The second one is in verse 18. That's the second reduction to absurdity. Who wants to read verse 18?
But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I by my works will show you my faith.
Now this is the second reduction to absurdity. What's the absurd position that he's pointing out here?
That they can be separated.
That they can be separated?
Yeah, definitely.
Certainly that. Mm-hmm.
Except that there are people who do great works who have no faith.
That's not his polemic. He's not concerned about works. He's concerned about, can you say faith is enough and I don't need to do works? He's never going to say the works are irrelevant. So I mean, he's not going to say the works are irrelevant. I mean, don't put the weight on the other side of the balance. His polemic is only against the one who says, I have faith. And he says, and that's enough. I have faith. My faith saves me. And I don't need to do works. That's who he's attacking. He's not saying anything at all about doing works without faith. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I see what you're saying, but I'm not sure I agree, because his sentence is, you have faith and I have works.
Mm-hmm.
So he has those as complete opposites.
But again, remember, this is a reduction of absurdity.
Okay.
What he's doing is trying to show that to split these off is absurd. It doesn't work. For him, you can't separate the two.
Okay.
And we might wonder, I mean, you can, again, if you want to come back with that, say to James that it might be possible that one could do works without without faith. I wonder, and I don't know this. I mean, it's a question worth pursuing, how that would be understood by the early Christians, the writers of these documents. And I just don't know. I mean, it's really not their issue that one would ever do a work that God would consider good and have no faith in God in the doing of that work. It doesn't seem to have been their, you know what I'm saying? It's not their worldview. It's not their mindset.
So what would be the difference between the person doing this, two people doing the same work, one who has faith and one who doesn't?
I think for James, certainly, the person who has faith and is doing the work is the ideal. That's what you want, is to bring the faith and the work together.
Oh, absolutely.
They would find, like I say, I believe, 2,000 years ago, if what we mean by faith is no belief that a God exists, they would find, if what we mean by faith is belief in God and some kind of allegiance to that belief, and that therefore having no faith means no belief in that, basically being an atheist, I believe they would find baffling then the category of that being a good work, because the goodness, which is its comparability to God, would be removed. You yourself would be saying it has nothing to do with God. Do you know
so
what
you
I mean?
Think the works would not be equal?
I think they would say the works would not be equal. and that an atheistic good work, again, that's the category we're talking about, a good work done by an atheist would to them be an inconceivable category, because the goodness is its reflection of God. So how can you even know what's good to do if you don't believe in God? Did you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So without a sense of what that goodness is that is ordering everything, how can you do a good work? It's our category. We're 2,000 years later. You know, we've been through Nietzsche, we've been through Freud, we've been through Darwin. And we can separate these things out in ways that I don't believe they could. And again, even though this is extremely fascinating, James's actual reduction here is, just to move on, is the absurdity of the person that says, I have faith and don't need to do any works. And he says, show me your faith without any works. What's the absurdity there? What's the reduced absurdity there?
You can't have faith without works.
That's certainly what he would say. You know, and in fact, how are you going to show anything if you don't do any works? You know, I mean, if all you do is just sort of stand there and I say, I have a lot of faith. How in the world do you know that's the truth? Do you know that's a true statement? I'm doing nothing. And as soon as I do the first thing, even if it is sing a hymn in church, well, that's a work. I've done something. So I've shown my faith. I mean, that's the reduction of absurdity at this point. Anytime you do anything that in any way shows your allegiance to Christianity, acts on the precepts of Christianity, you're showing your faith. You can't not show your faith. You can't separate faith out and say, well, I have faith, I don't need to do works. You may not want to do certain works, but as soon as you get into any kind of Christian activity, you're showing your faith by your works. You can't get into the position of saying you don't need works. Because that would be, like I say, the spiritual couch potato. Just lying staring at the ceiling. And whatever's going on in your head, James would say, who knows? We have to be agnostic about that. We have no way of knowing if you have faith or not, regardless of what you say.
But the, church, the church is full of spiritual couch potatoes.
I think so. but you get this reduction to absurdity. He's saying you can't simply claim to have faith and never have that in any kind of physical manifestation, any kind of external manifestation. The third reduction of absurdity is verse 19, which is, like I say, one of the funniest verses in the Bible. You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Now, what's going on there? What's that line of argument? Well, let me just cut to the chase and say, for example, if you assume that faith is simply about consent to intellectual propositions, in other words, that God is one, or even a kind of, that's not sufficient, consent to an intellectual proposition, even more chilling, he says that the spiritual other entities, the malevolent entities, know a lot about God. Remember in the Gospel of Mark, for a long time, the only beings that say whenever Jesus walks in the room, you're the Son of God, are the demons possessing the people that Jesus is about to expel. Knowing Jesus is the Son of God by no means puts you in the righteous category. The demons also know exactly who Jesus is. So that's the reduction of absurdity there. If all you do is say, well, no, I acknowledge Jesus, the Son of God. I got the Spirit of the Son of God. I pray saying, Abba, I'm clear about all of this. And again, he would say, and there's no concern for neighbors, no concern for the marginalized. You're as good as the demons any day.
Is James talking about the triune God in this?
Absolutely out of his mind. I mean, that's not anywhere in his mind here. The explicit phrasing of Trinitarian theology didn't happen until the 4th century. And for sure, it's not of interest or concern to James. So, I mean, we would say, looking back 2,000 years, of course, the God he's talking about is the triune God. What other God is there? But that would not be terminology James would get into. It's our later development of theology that put that up. Now he goes on to say, let me just say also that it's interesting, he's already said faith without works is dead. This new category is almost faith without works is demonic, which is a kind of troubling place to put this. He's now going to say faith without works is barren. And this is, Dale is not here this morning, but Dale was the one who was talking about this passage in James, where James picks up the same verses that Paul used. Abraham believed and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. So who would like to read verses 21 through 24?
Was not our ancestor Abraham justified by works when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was brought to completion by the works. Thus the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone.
This follows right along with the things he was saying earlier, that it was not enough for Abraham to say, I believe, and not in some way show his belief. And there are many things, of course, that could be pointed to. I mean, Abraham leaving Ur, for example, or any number of things. The one that James picks is, of course, the story of Abraham offering Isaac on the altar. What do you make of this argument? Again, shrewd. If James is trying to do is counter Paul's claiming of this verse. We saw that yesterday. Abraham believed, God reckoned it to him as righteousness, a promise made before the law. The law does not annul that promise. That was sufficient. Paul doesn't breathe a word about the offering of Isaac. So James wants to take that same verse and say, now wait a minute. If we say that Abraham believed, how did Abraham show that? So he makes the reference to the offering of Isaac. What would you like to pull out of this, say about it?
Well, the thing that occurred to me was, the thing that occurred to me right away was not even theological, was by those standards, By the standards that he just set of Abraham, I mean, if God has to ask me, if I have to show my righteousness or my faith, if I have to, by sacrificing my child on an altar, that's a tough one. I mean, if he's going to hold that up as the standard for the works that I do that demonstrate my faith. I also find something really odd happening inside me. Paul hasn't always been, I haven't always considered Paul a woman's best friend. But I find myself really wanting to jump to his defense.
Oh, of course.
Right
of
now.
Course.
It's like you're way over, it's like being, I've faced this in my own life where someone just takes what you say and takes it straight over the top in ways in which you never meant.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm always,
right.
I'm feeling right. That way about Paul right now, and that's odd for me because, frankly, until this little Bible study, I never thought I'd ever much defend him.
And it's Paul's culture you may not want to defend.
Yeah.
Paul himself has some not bad qualities. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what I'm saying. There have been sort of paper tigers that have been set up all the way through this, some of which I don't think James is doing maliciously. I think he is trying to counter the misinterpretations of Paul that have begun to crop up. I'm not even sure that he's directly speaking about Paul per se as much as about how Paul can be abused and misinterpreted.
In this piece, it sounds also like God doesn't know our hearts, but God only knows what we really think by instead of God knowing us. I mean, Jesus could come up to a person before they said or did anything. Jesus knew them.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus knew that they had a deep faith, whether they had said or done anything. Frequently that happens. And James seems to be contradicting that, that until Abraham actually gave the sacrifice or made the move to make Isaac a sacrifice, then God understood Abraham to be righteous. And I would argue that with James.
And again, on various levels, because I think the story is horrific enough about God asking for Isaac to be offered up. Let's not rush to extremes here. I'm not sure that James would ever say that God doesn't know our hearts. You know, I mean, he's not going to agree with that statement. I think the issue is whether or not our, if you look at verse 22, there are two very interesting words, because I think the issue is not God, but the issue is us, and whether or not we are going to, in fact, reach our completion, whether our faith is going to reach our completion. In verse 22, he talks about, you see that faith was active along with his works, and the word here is sunerke. And once again, you have that interesting word related to energy. You know, faith and works were active together. We get the English word synergy from this. Now, again, what is going on here is not that one thing, let me start that another way. What is going on here is that it's essential for both to work together to produce the result. That's what synergy is all about. They harmonize and together produce the result that either single one could not do. So he says here, you see that faith was active along with his works. You see that faith synerge with his works, was synergistic with the works. And together, he says, faith was brought to completion by the works. That word, interestingly enough, is this one, eteleothe. This means perfect. So what we're talking about here is the sense that what you do is reach the perfection of your faith by your works. Not that you don't have faith, not that God does not know your heart, not all this other sort of stuff, but if you want, in fact, to bring your faith to its culminating point, to its point of perfection, it happens through works. That works, in fact, working with your faith, bring that to perfection. Not in a sense of, how do I say this? I don't want you to hear this quantitatively. It's not like there are a certain number of things that need to be done and you finally get an end product that is a good end product. But qualitatively, instead, that if your works and your faith can work together, what will in fact happen is the perfection of your faith. Your faith will in fact be made perfect. It will be completed. It will reach its goal, if you will. Because that's the other meaning of this, which is related to this word telos, which is the goal. That's where we're headed. For Greek thought, our ability to see a goal and to in fact arrive at it, to reach that goal, was perfection. That ability to reach what you were aiming for was perfection. Not the static state, but the ability to reach the goal. So again, if you begin to look at these polemical verses that sound like they're against Paul in this light, there's, to me at least, a more sympathetic feel in James. What he wants you to do is know the perfection of your own faith. Know the accomplishment, the ability of your own faith. Yes, ma'am?
To me, whenever you have, I haven't looked at it like this before, so it's very interesting, but whenever you have two strong personalities that believe very strongly in how they interpret something, there is always going to be conflict or disagreement. And so they both will slightly exaggerate.
Absolutely.
So that their point will be made and the other point will not look quite as strong as the other person is originally saying.
Right.
But
that's one of the gifts of strong personalities, is their ability to exaggerate to a certain degree, because then it makes us stop and go, oh my word, I haven't thought about that.
Yeah.
But you have, but to me, it's a gift both of these people have, and I don't see one as negative or one as positive or one is telling the better truth or the not truth. What both are doing is making me stop and think and re-examine my own life.
Yes.
And if they hadn't exaggerated, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
No, thank you for saying that, Ruth. And in fact, as you'll remember from my first session, that's exactly why I put these two letters together. They are both extremely strong statements of what has all too often been thrown in opposite camps in church teaching, as if they really were enemies of each other. We're here for the healing of the world. My deep faith is that both of these letters must be true. We must find ways to, in fact, see the truth in both of these letters and live them together. We're not being, in fact, perfect Christians if we decide we're going to pick James over Paul or Paul over James, because they're both in Scripture. You can't sort of select one. We are out of time. Let me just say very briefly that the passages in chapter 3 that we have not had time to look at have to do with those of us who teach, he says, and how careful we need to be. That's certainly true. But all of chapter 3 is about bridling the tongue and how much destruction the tongue can bring about. Certainly something that Ruth, for example, is talking about in the negotiating and conflict management things. The other thing I want to call your attention to are the practical suggestions, starting with verse 13 of chapter 5 at the very end. Just at some moment that you can look at those, because that will give you a clearer glimpse into what James is really talking about when he's talking about the works that he wants the congregation to be involved in. Visiting the sick, you know, praying with each other. In fact, when someone wanders away, bringing that person back in a gentle way. These are the works that James is talking about. And all of them have to do with the harmonizing and the reweaving of the community, the holding the community together, making the community one, as opposed to something that I achieve on my own and that makes me good in God's eyes. Okay. Sorry we sort of ran a little bit out of time. Tomorrow we finish what we're going to be doing. We go back to Paul, and a lot of our work in the second half of the session will be to look for points of congruence or convergence between Paul and James. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Michael. Thank
you. Hold on.
Yes, the verse that struck me was chapter 3, verse 1, teach us.
I couldn't get it off.
Yes.
Reserve myself, and the doubt that questions will need to further inquire.
Last night,
they're very different.
I know that it's now something. I still have some nodding up here. Deep meditation.
Recently, what a revelation.
Yeah.
Seems that way to me. Seems that way to me.
And I don't know quite how to say what I feel to them.
And
so now,
if you're asking, what might be said, I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably worth a conversation back home.
Now I have one more.
Because that would be a long conversation. Yeah. If you need to ask. Perhaps your pastor or someone would be but it's very hard. It's a very hard conversation. Yeah, pastor, particularly with Unitarians.
Michael, I'll meet you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, please.
It had to do with Isaac and Abraham.
Yeah.
And it's probably off the point of what you're trying to make, but that I find it pretty troubling because what I recall from the Old Testament is they were telling the Israelites to stop sacrificing the firstborn. Okay, so maybe, I don't know if this is correct, but what I have is maybe the point is Abraham had faith not to sacrifice his son. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I don't know what the time frame is when he was doing it. It was at the time when all the prophets were saying not to do it.
Yeah. It's a passage that is so troubling and has troubled people ever since it was put down into Genesis, that it's, and people find all kinds of ways to interpret what was really going on. I once heard a very stunning reading, again, very disturbing reading, that the one who is being probed here is God, not Abraham. Mm. God's the one with the question. Abraham doesn't have a question. Mm. And when you put that spin on it, it's like, whoa, God doesn't see our hearts. God doesn't know things, you know. God doesn't know Abraham's faith already. He has to ask for this. Mm-hmm. And yet, I mean, if you actually look at the way the story gets told, that's the one that actually makes the most sense given the words. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I've also heard interpretations, for example, that Abraham just imagined that God asked this. And I think, well, no, that's not the way it's written. Whereas the way it's written is that it's God wanted to test. And that suggests that the insecurity is on God's part, not Abraham's. Mm-hmm. And that the discovery is God's discovery, not Abraham's. And that's a little bit of a bombshell. And there is no way, I mean, this story continues to generate interpretations
Well, the prophets clearly said stop doing it.
No question. And it's very clear that he does not kill his son. Mm-hmm. You know. And let me just say in parenthesis that there are even some Jewish commentators that say, no, it's not clear he doesn't kill his son. Mm-hmm. Because the verse says Abraham came down from the mountain. It says nothing at all about Isaac coming down from the mountain. Mm-hmm. So that's another one that we put that on the show. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I'm glad.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Right, preaching.
Well, nice to see you, Mel.
Yes, it's one that was very struggling with James from my very home. Do you want to walk around?
Ruth and I are going to take a hike.
Oh, okay. I'm
maybe
sorry.
What we can. No,
well,
no,
one thing.
Maybe what we can do is just meet for chat later today.
Completely other topic. Have you ever heard of Bible Works by Hermeneutica? It's a season wrong. Do you have any idea where I could get it?
No.
Ben, who was here before, had it, and it's just such a great tool, and I can't find it.
Am I remembering right that Hermeneutica comes out of Fortress Press?
It's not Oxford Fortress.
It's not?
Fortress.
Oxford Fortress, yeah.
Yeah, no, they don't carry it. I've written them a letter and asked about it. So, well,
I'm afraid I don't. No.
Huh, okay, I'll try.
Sorry about that.
That's okay, I just thought you might. The light switches in here are really stupid.
Yeah, no, and even so, it's not.